What healthcare revolutions are on the horizon in 2025? How will they affect healthcare providers and patients? Our guest has tried to sort it out with his annual list of top 10 healthcare industry predictions that he shared on the Forbes website.
I think we're entering wartime in American healthcare, where we're going to need to rebuild things from the studs. And the folks who renovate the house aren't necessarily going to be the people who built the house.
Our guest is Dr. Sachin Jain. He's held top positions at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology. In recent years, he's been a leader in the private sector and has a unique perspective on the entire field.
Gone are the days where, you know, your doctor was an independent practitioner who had a ton of pride in his or her job. What you have today now is everyone works for health systems. Everyone feels anonymous. The health systems are large. The health plans are big. You know, and it's the big battling the big.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, Dr. Sachin Jain, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
It's great to be with you. Thanks.
Yeah, and first of all, it's been too long. It's way back in 2018, and then we were focusing in on chronic disease management, and we know that really remains a concern, but we're going to broaden our conversation by discussing your annual list of predictions for healthcare, and you write, the crystal ball never fails until, of course, it does. First, how accurate have you been through the years? And maybe tell our listeners, how do you go about making these predictions?
I've been very accurate, but I want to say on the fact that I haven't been on your show is that I've been waiting by my phone. And, you know, it took six, 7 years for us to get back in touch. So I really appreciate the outreach.
Absolutely.
It's great to be with you and your listeners. So my crystal ball is really the synthesis of everything that I'm hearing. I've got my ear to the ground. You know, there's a certain amount of things that I'm hearing, certain amount of things that I'm feeling. And then there's a number of inferences that I make every year just based on trying to connect dots and the pattern recognition of now having worked in this industry for over two decades. And I've been making these predictions now for, I don't know, 6-7 years. And, you know, they're probably the thing that I write that gets read the most every year, you know, on average 20, 30, 40,000 readers. And so, you know, I feel an obligation to try to put out, you know, some predictions that will provoke people. Sometimes it's wishful thinking. Sometimes it's just kind of a sober state of where things are. Probably the prediction that got the most attention this year is the DEI as we know it, or health equity as we know it, is going to end. And I think, you know, the early signs are that I was correct. You're seeing this administration take aim at DEI and health equity programs pretty aggressively and pretty directly. And I think, you know, the most benign view of it is that we're going to see, you know, improvement of healthcare for everybody, but without kind of specific focus on specific populations. But perhaps the more sobering view of it is that, you know, a lot of the progress that we've made over the last couple of years in the health equity arena is going to be put on pause or will be set back.
Mm-hmm. Well, a significant number of those predictions that you've made focus on what's happening in Washington. And we all, of course, are paying attention to what's happening in Washington. But number one on your list seems to be that wellness will be front and center. And you say this will occur because of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s expected role leading HHS. You wrote that heretofore fringe ideas about wellness and disease causation and medications will continue to go mainstream. So fill us in more on how you see this actually playing out. It's more than a bully pulpit. You actually have somebody in a position to affect change. And what do you think might happen?
I think the American public is, by and large, sick of the sick care system. They feel like the system shows up when they're sick, but does very little to keep them healthy in the first place. And I think you have, for the very first time, an HHS secretary who's speaking that language, who is appealing to them in that way, and I think has some interesting ideas to support the health and wellness of people, and then some controversial ideas about supporting the health and wellness of people. What I will say is it's time to put your seatbelt on because we're in for a ride. I think the FDA is going to be looked at very closely in terms of what it does, not just on the medication, the drug side, but also on the food side. And you have a really activist, FDA administrator appointed in Marty Makary, somebody whose ideas I think are actually pretty smart. And he's building a pretty good team. And so I think there's going to be a hard look at the work of the FDA and potentially a lot of FDA reform. I think the combination of Dr. Oz and RFK Jr., two words you probably never thought would be mentioned in the same sentences, two names that you'd never thought you'd mention together, is going to be a dynamic one. I think, Robert F. Kennedy is going to be focused on wellness, chronic disease prevention, and chronic disease management. And I think, having someone like Dr. Oz in the CMS administrator seat, somebody who's written extensively about the need for reform in the Medicare program, he's been pretty pro Medicare Advantage. I think will be interesting for the American public, which is really divided right now between people who are in traditional Medicare and people who are in Medicare Advantage. But this program, which in 2010, covered just 25% of Americans, I'm talking about Medicare Advantage, now covers over 50% of Americans. Right. And but there hasn't been the regulatory kind of revolution that needed to happen to really administer that program and kind of evolve that program. And so look for that to happen over the next couple of years as well with Dr. Oz in that seat.
All right. So we have an implicit prediction that RFK will be the next HHS secretary.
Do you think he won't be?
No, I'm just asking. No, I'm just, I know I mean, there are a lot of people lined up, but it sounds like
he's going to get confirmed this week. If he doesn't, I'll eat these words.
That's okay. We got it on tape.
But let
me just pull up and pull the thread on that, because you also predict that some obscure government deputies will matter more. And I should note, you've been in government at CMS.
I've been an obscure government deputy. So I know how much those people can matter and how much they don't matter when you've got strong executives in place. Look, this is Dr. Oz's first tour of duty at CMS. What I've heard consistently, though, and positively, is that he's like learning the job. He is calling former CMS administrators. He's really trying to understand how to sit in that job and be highly effective in that job. But I think part of what he's heard from people is really appoint great deputies. And so he's gone to White House staffers, historic White House staffers. He's looked at congressional staffers, and he's trying to put together the best team that he can put together to really, run the Center for Medicare, to run the Center for Medicaid, to run the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. I will say I'm a little worried about the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. I think that it's probably a prime target for DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, because it's had a mixed record. $10 billion budget that self-renews every 10 years. Highly politicized agency that hasn't necessarily lived up to the hype and promise. I was part of the founding team, so I can take some responsibility for it myself. But I can say that CMS is going to look and operate very differently in 2026, 27, 28 than it did in 2021 and 22.
Well, also, while we stay on the federal level, I think this is a quote that you think Medicare Advantage will make a roaring comeback. I didn't think it ever left, actually. It seemed to me it's been kind of a steady uphill. And certainly we've heard the Medicare administrators talk about the desire to get everybody into a value-based plan, into a Medicare Advantage or another value-based plan. You lead a nonprofit Medicare Advantage plan, SCAN. So knowing it as well as you do, what makes you feel bullish about Medicare Advantage? What's going to take it this next distance?
Well, the last couple of years have been hard for the industry. I would say the new risk model, what everyone in the industry calls V28, kind of was an effective rate cut to the industry. So I think, plans were forced to do more with less. The star rating system has become, more and more challenging and harder to achieve high star ratings. And you're starting to see, you know, some of the flaws with the star rating systems, with all the lawsuits that have followed Scan's lawsuit against, you know, the Biden administration for its use of you know, cut points that seemed out of line with what had been published in the regulation. And so I think, you know, most people who've worked in Medicare Advantage would say that the last couple of years have been years where we've been forced to imagine doing more with less. And, you know, the curve that you're talking about, that kind of steady upward curve, had actually flattened a little bit the last couple of years. And I would say, you know, what's now happening is, I think you now have a CMS administrator who is on record, as having said that he thinks all Medicare beneficiaries should be in a Medicare Advantage plan. I don't think we're going to get all the way there, to be clear. I think, you know, traditional Medicare is still very popular for those people who can afford it. But I will say that Medicare Advantage is going to become more and more mainstream. It's going to get, I think, some of the, you know, kind of regulatory changes that made it harder and harder to perform in Medicare Advantage may get rolled back or slowed down. And I think for that reason, this industry is going to see even more growth in the next couple of years than it did the last few.
You don't think it would be doged in any way here just because of its cost between the regular plan?
I think Medicaid is going to get doged a bit. I think Medicare is not going to get doged. Do I think that there's going to be some fixes because of, you know, the shift, the differences in costs? I think there may be, but I would say, you know, on the margins, this is an administration that's going to try to see more and more people in Medicare Advantage, and they know what it takes to do that, which is you've got to make those plans more generous. And the truth is, Medicare Advantage is a better deal for low-income Americans, and we forget that. I think a lot of the academics who kind of have taken aim at Medicare Advantage have not looked sufficiently at traditional Medicare, which in 2025 is a bad program. It doesn't cover dental. It doesn't cover vision. It doesn't cover audiology. It leaves people with very high copays. It forces them to pay very high premiums, both for Part B as well as for Part D, as well as for supplemental policies. You know, a couple, a husband and wife, can be out of pocket for over $1,000 a month in extra premiums in, you know, traditional Medicare. Whereas Medicare Advantage, Southern California, there are many zero premium plans.
Sure.
After people have paid their Part B premiums.
You sound a little like Bernie Sanders on dental's not covered, vision's not covered. So, but maybe from a different perspective of where it should be covered.
No one's ever said I sound like Bernie Sanders. Reflect on how I feel about that.
Tell me this. Okay. You know, you talked a little bit about Medicaid in terms of it being doged. It has far more members than Medicare does. It's grown over the years. Where do you particularly see a focus in terms of cutting it back on the FMAP program, or what's the broad array of changes you might see in the Medicaid program?
Look, I think you're gonna see no new states adopt Medicaid. So Medicaid expansion is going to hit, you know, a full pause or a halt. I think you might even see some states pull back their Medicaid plans. I think you're going to see work requirements introduced in almost every red state in the country. And I think you're going to see, you know, you're going to see the administration make it harder and harder for people to access these benefits, particularly targeting, you know, undocumented and immigrant populations, which, you know, have been accessing Medicaid in some states. And so I think you're going to see a major, major rollback of the Medicaid program, which I think is going to be difficult to watch for many of us who, I think, have fought a good portion of our careers to get people universal right. coverage. If we're cutting it, you know, in service of trying to get people coverage of another format, I think that's going to be great. But I'm not optimistic that that's an area of focus for this administration.
Well, one of President Trump's first moves, and you've alluded to this, was to kind of fire the diversity, equity, and inclusion officials throughout federal government. And you've written, I think I noted, that the health equity field will end as we know it. But what follows what we know? Do you have a sense of what will replace it? Because the data is unlikely to change just because we stop the officials with the titles. We know that we have huge issues of health equity in the country. I'm sure you see it in your own plan and respond accordingly. So what will replace it, even if we're not calling it what we did a year ago or
look, let me be clear. I think, you know, those of us who've been focused on trying to right these wrongs and to address, you know, huge disparities in populations are going to continue to do so. Right. Scan Health Plan is going to continue to do so. But I do think the federal efforts around this are going to, you know, be, are going to hit pause. And, you know, I think there were a number of different health equity initiatives that were launched. There's a health equity index that's being built into the STARS program. And I think those are areas that we got to watch really closely as an industry and see, you know, are they going to go away? My suspicion, my strong suspicion is they're going to go away. I think the work is going to really sit with the private sector now. And you're going to see that there's going to be organizations who are going to lean into continuing this work. You're going to also see organizations that are going to press pause. They're going to fire their diversity officers in the next round of layoffs. So I think there's going to be a lot of change here.
Yeah.
But I will say, I think there's a lot of resentment about how this agenda was pursued over the last couple of years, in part because it almost felt like the agenda was pursued singularly as opposed to, you know, a broader focus on reimagining like the whole Medicare program or, you know, all of healthcare, which is broken for everyone. And so I do think that those of us who care about this need to take note and we need to actually balance our messaging, which is that, you know, we are going to focus on improving health equity. But we're also going to be focusing on improving the system for everyone. And I think that that's a more winning message. And that's, I think, the message that the American public needs to hear in this time where this country is as divided as it is.
Dr. Jane, you think misinformation is going to get much worse. I'm wondering if you could explain why you think it will get worse. I don't know how it could get worse. And also, you've also been thinking about ideas to fix the problem.
Look, I think, you know, most of us these days are digging holes and jumping into them because we don't know what information to process and so we're just avoiding information altogether is what I'm seeing a number of people do. They're tuning out of both alternative forms of media as well as mainstream media because, you know, the more you know a topic, the more you realize how misinformed, you know, people are and how much misinformation actually really spreads. Look, I think the work really sits on the shoulders of society to, number one, regulate itself, the tech companies to give society to regulate, you know, the information that is spread. And then I think it's also just important for us to become better consumers of information. I think when I was in elementary school, we had intensive education on like the sources of information and the quality of sources. And we were trained on how to scrutinize the quality of evidence and the quality of sources. And I think for whatever reason, that's been beaten out of our education. And I think people have forgotten that not all sources of information are created equal. And I think that there's this egalitarian ideal around information, which is like everyone's opinion matters equally. And I think everyone's opinion and experience matters, but I think, you know, expertise also matters. And I think what we've experienced is almost the end of expertise the last 5 years, in part because people feel betrayed by experts who maybe were too definitive at different points in conveying, you know, firm opinions where they should have conveyed doubt or hypothesis. And we saw that play out in COVID, where everyone became a COVID pundit and was very definitive very quickly, when in fact, you know, this was an evolving field. And, you know, for a guy who talks a lot, I kept my mouth shut most of the pandemic because I wasn't close to it and didn't know enough about it. I'm not an epidemiologist, but lots of people who are not epidemiologists started speaking up, and the American public actually listened to those people, sometimes to their own detriment. And so again, I think we have to work on restoring trust. And I think it starts with all of us becoming better communicators and more nuanced communicators. And I think, you know, many times we've disrespected people's capacity to absorb nuance and uncertainty, and we've actually conveyed things with more certainty than we should. And I think we have to actually train people to think in terms of probabilities and uncertainties and possibilities, as opposed to, you know, living in a world where there's black and white. And I think, unfortunately, that's at the heart of a lot of misinformation, is people's desire to live in black and white.
Well, I think that's going to come into play now as we hear more about bird flu happening, and we're at that early stage and people are framing up, you know, what they think it is or what impact it might have. But any thoughts about the implications there as we may be, you know, pre-pandemic. One hopes there's never a pandemic, but I think we've heard from all the experts they happen every 20 years or so. What's your sense there in terms of what people should be doing in discerning information about what's happening in that world?
Look, I think even as we get better information, I think people's capacity to hear it right now is compromised. And I think we're in for, this is going to be one of these situations where things are going to get worse before they get better. People are going to get burned because of misinformation and because of myth. People did get burned because of misinformation and myth. People forget that lots of people died early in the COVID pandemic, like died of COVID. You know, it wasn't, they didn't die of the vaccination, like, you know, in the way that people are talking about today, people died of COVID. And so, again, I think a lot of times things are going to get worse before they get better. And I don't think that there's any clear, easy answer, unfortunately, to the misinformation wars right now, because people realize that misinformation is power. We used to say information is power. And now I think misinformation is power. And we've got to move beyond that world. And I think we're going to have to go back to a world where we have some confidence in expertise and authority, because, Joe Public is not trained to necessarily inform us about what the treatments are and what a double blind, controlled trial is, and why, an observational study is inferior to a double blind, placebo controlled study. So again, I think that, this may be a hard learned lesson for the American public, but, I think we're destined to learn those hard lessons the hard way.
Well, Dr. Jane, you continue with your predictions. Obviously, we've seen a lot of turnover in the top federal elected official positions, and we're going to see a lot more in the appointed people. But you've also predicted that there's going to be a considerable turnover in the top corporate jobs. I assume in healthcare you were referencing, as well as a return to big corporate transactions. I'm really curious, what do you see happening at the leadership level in organizations like your own, in these large health systems, large privatized health systems that we have all over the country? What's this next generation of leadership going to be like, do you think, and how will it change things?
Well, what I would say is I think we're in a period right now where things are really hard. It is not easy to run a health system. Things are not always up and to the right. It's not easy to run a managed care plan right now. And I think when the going gets tough, organizations sometimes need different kinds of leaders. I talk about the notion of wartime leaders versus peacetime leaders. And I think we're entering wartime in American healthcare, where we're going to need to rebuild things from the studs. And the folks who renovate the house aren't necessarily going to be the people who built the house, because you need a fresh pair of eyes on just about everything in order to really, reimagine things. And I think you saw this after Brian Thompson's murder. I mean, this cold-hearted, unforgivable murder was received with a lot of corporate platitudes from an industry that should have been saying more and should be saying, we're sorry and we can do better. Not that anything about that murder was excusable, but, the aftermath was that, we have an American public that is sick and tired of the broken status quo of American healthcare. And it's this last generation of leaders who got us here. And I think it's going to be a next generation of leaders who's going to pull us out of it. And I do think that leadership matters. I think, a number of people will say to me, you overestimate the importance of leadership. It's all about the incentives. It's about, what shareholders want, and it's about what boards want. But the truth is that there are things we can be doing today to make things better that we have just normalized. We've normalized the abnormal in American healthcare. And I think we have an opportunity to take a fresh look at how we do utilization management, how we deny claims, how we price services, how we actually represent those prices to consumers, how we treat people when they walk through our doors. All of those things are changeable without acts of Congress. They're all changeable just through better leadership. And you see it in organizations that are well-run and then organizations that treat people like they're not people.
Well, let's pull a thread on the private sector and what's happening there. You highlight states like Oregon and California, who've put in place some healthcare transaction review boards to regulate the role of private equity in healthcare. And you think this kind of scrutiny will continue? It's gotten pretty bad. You can see whether it's there are a whole number of folks that have been in the eye of the FTC and others and state regulators across the country. Tell us a little more about what type of scrutiny we might see going forward.
Look, our federal regulators were asleep at the wheel for the last two decades or three decades as big healthcare got bigger and small healthcare kind of evaporated. Gone are the days where, you know, your doctor was an independent practitioner who had a ton of pride in his or her job. What you have today now is everyone works for health systems. Everyone feels anonymous. The health systems are large. The health plans are big, you know, and it's the big battling the big. And the truth is that it's gotten too big. And, you know, the patients are less happy, the people who work in healthcare are less happy, and the prices are higher. There's literally no evidence that, you know, the consolidation that we've experienced over the last two decades, which was supposed to create administrative efficiencies, which was supposed to drive quality improvement, actually improved anything. And so, you know, the FTC has got to look at itself. All the bodies that regulate healthcare need to look at themselves and say, hey, this thing that we enabled, this thing that we supported, this thing that we let happen unfettered, you know, maybe wasn't the right thing. And maybe we need to think about breaking up health systems or breaking up large conglomerates. And again, I think some decisions will be made that aren't going to be in the best interests of patients. I do think we should probably see, you know, it's going to be a market by market, situation by situation judgment that needs to be made. But right now, you know, there's been, you know, there's too much quote unquote big healthcare right now. And I think we need to take a hard look at it and think about how do we create healthcare that feels smaller to people and more personal and more intimate and is delivered in a higher quality way.
Well, I have to, I can't resist following that up with a question about what one might call public-private systems. And I'm thinking of Veteran Affairs Public, and I'm thinking of the community health center movement you might think is public-private, a lot of federal rules, most skewed to the benefit of low-income and special populations, but all private organizations. What's the place in this landscape for those kinds of organizations to do what you're talking about, to make care personal, even though they're wrapped within a strong structure that really tries to skew towards access and quality?
Look, I think some of those organizations do an incredible job. I'm a VA doctor, and I can tell you it provides a highly integrated experience to our veterans and has gotten dramatically better over the last couple of decades. And I think that there's lots of lessons that we can learn from those types of models. That said, I think, you know, you'd have to be very countercultural. You'd have to kind of build some regulatory relief for, you know, people who did want to go, you know, put the genie back in the bottle and support private practice in a different way. You know, I work with a number of different, you know, startup companies, and the ones that I think are most exciting are the ones that are focused on, you know, physician autonomy and restoring, you know, kind of a sense of pride and capability to private practice physicians in the context of quote unquote big healthcare. And, you know, I think that that's where we need to, you know, enable people more.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about joy and confidence. How do we bring back joy to the people who are working in healthcare? And how do we bring back confidence by the public in our healthcare system?
Well, it's not through more chief wellness officers. It's not through, you know, more yoga classes for the people who work in healthcare. It's not through, you know, providing people with access to the Headspace app, even if the Headspace app is a good app. It's through actually making the work better. And I think that that's where we've lost focus is you got to make the work better. You got to make it easier to be a doctor or a nurse in American healthcare today. And I'll include pharmacists in that too. Walk into, you know, your average retail chain pharmacy. The lines are incredibly long. The experience is terrible. The people are harried and they are doing the very best that they can. Walk into any emergency room today. You know, people are not powered to do the work that they need to do. They don't have the equipment. They don't have the tools. They don't have the solutions. I think there's going to be some relief through some of the ambient documentation tools that have been developed, you know, the Abridges of the world that will make it easier for people to document and take some of the, you know, least rewarding work out of being a doctor. But I think, you know, the reality is that a lot of re-engineering of the work needs to happen. And there's right now people are buried in administrivia. And, you know, that administrivia comes both from the health systems as well as the health plans.
Well, I think this is a good note to wrap up on for today, but I think we'll have you back on the show as we move forward into this new future that's
you
ahead
of us.
You
said that before, Marv. So
I know. Got to do it sooner.
This time I'm not going to be sitting by my phone, okay?
Yeah, but yeah. I'll know how to find you. So all thank right. you, Dr. Jane, for joining us, and thanks to our audience for being here. Just a reminder, be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube. Find us on Facebook and X with our account name, CHC Radio. As always, go online to chcradio.com to sign up for email updates. And please share your thoughts and comments about this program and all our programs. We're sure you have a lot of thoughts. Take care. Be well. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.